The court is ready to hear argument in 080613 NAFTA Traders against.
Please the court. Mr. Bush will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court and good morning. The Court of Appeals erred when it refused to enforce a critical provision of the party's agreement to arbitrate, thereby undermining the party's right to choose in contract how they wanted their dispute resolved. The arbitrator in this case ran wild, exceeded the authority that was given to him by the parties, did so by taking an employment discrimination case, which falls in a very specific paradigm, a disparate treatment reduction in force case, treated it more like a sexual harassment case, got the totally wrong result, and then fashioned a remedy that does not exist either in law or in equity.
Which is exactly what happened in Hall.
Absolutely. And obviously it's our position that, first of all, that Hall does not apply to the Texas Arbitration Act, obviously begging the question of which act applies.
Well, and let's agree it doesn't. But why shouldn't we follow the same law so that we don't have two separate bodies of law on the issue? What's different about the TAA that should mandate that we go a different direction?
Well, Your Honor, consistency is an important value. I submit it's secondary to the value of honoring the party's agreement, because that underlines the whole public policy of arbitration, and why I think that the Hall rule, if carried too far, and the rule that the respondents ask you to do, will deeply damage arbitration in this state. If the NAFTA's traders, the petitioners of this world, if the citizens of the state of Texas find that the courts are not enforcing their agreements to arbitrate the way they structure them and only gives them part of what they thought they were getting, and find that they're in a forum that can be more arbitrary than perhaps what they feared when they were in court, the smart people who draft these arbitration clauses are going to quit drafting them. You'll see jury waiver clauses in Ray Prudential. You'll find that we'll be in court with contractual limitations on what the court ought to do.
And what's wrong with that?
Well, I think it's always been the express public policy of the state to encourage arbitration. And I think that if you don't give the parties what they ask for,
it's not really been to encourage arbitration. It's been to put it on the same level as other contracts. And if parties then decide to go with jury waivers, then that's enforcing contracts as well. So I'm just trying to understand, if I'm a litigant and I'm trying to decide whether it's the TAA or the FAA, why should it be different and have me buffeted between these two different systems depending upon which one applies? I mean, we may disagree with Hall. I understand you do, and let's say we do, but even if we disagree with Hall, why shouldn't we at least have a uniform policy?
Right. Well, first let me say again that in our point of view, if the United States Supreme Court were hearing this case, it would also rule for petitioner, because our distinction in our arbitration clause and the clause in the Hall Street case is very importantly different on its unambiguous face. Having said that, let me get back to your question then about what are the differences between the Federal Arbitration Act and the Texas Arbitration Act. And obviously they're very similar. There are some differences. For example, one says shall and the other says may in terms of enforcement. One that I noticed more recently, for example, the Texas Arbitration Act is broader on whether a award should be vacated. The Federal Arbitration Act, for example, only cites two types of misconduct is the word, failure to hear evidence or postpone a hearing. The Texas Arbitration Act in one subsection 2C says misconduct or willful behavior, and then subsequent subsections 3B and C cite refusing to postpone or hear relevant evidence, implying therefore that misconduct in the Texas Arbitration Act must mean something broader beyond those two criteria. It's the best two I can come up with. Other than that, I think anyone who says that they're not very similar is going to have a difficult problem maintaining that, but there are differences. And
what is the advantage from a, if you know, from your client's point of view or from a business point of view, from a client, from a party's point of view, of having a provision that sends a dispute to arbitration, but then leaves open basically full appellate review? Why not just go to trial in the first place?
Well, there are a lot of advantages, real and perceived, about arbitration in terms of expense, in terms of how fast the process works, in terms of confidentiality and how less public it is, in terms of, in certain types of arbitrations, in terms of expertise, and I'm thinking from my own experience, like there's a certain type of securities arbitration of customer complaints against their brokers, and there's a whole regime of expert panels dealing with securities and stock trading. So there are different reasons that the parties want to go to arbitration that are very practical. And let's be real, one of the really biggest ones is there's a fear of, if I may use the term, arbitrariness on the part of juries. And a lot of it's a flight from juries, and yet sometimes, unfortunately...
About a jury waiver.
And that would be a solution to that particular issue. But in response to the question of the various reasons why it makes sense for parties to agree to good arbitration, that's one of several good reasons.
But it seems to me that many of those are lost or at least compromised if you then go back into the legal system and go through the appellate process.
That's all outweighed by the benefit, I would think, from the parties of knowing that the arbitrator isn't totally free to be completely arbitrary. I mean, let's face it.
Completely arbitrary?
I'm sorry?
What was that you said?
For the arbitrator to be totally arbitrary. If there's no check at all on what the arbitrator does, as there is, for example, with juries, then both parties, unless they agree to limit his powers, which they have the right to do, but if they don't limit their powers, they're basically asking the arbitrator to do virtually anything the arbitrator wants. And if the parties agree to that, then they should get that. But in this case, the parties didn't agree to that. They asked for something very different.
Do you know if there has been reaction to the Hall case contractually by waiving jury provisions, waiving juries, and selecting particular forms, things like that?
I can only tell you my practice, what I tell my clients, and that is that, frankly, particularly in light of the Hall case, and even before the Hall case, you might seriously consider waiving a jury and staying within the court system than going to the arbitration system. Getting back to your previous question, a lot of the reasons that parties go to arbitration sometimes are perceived and not real. Arbitration, unfortunately, in many cases, has become a process as expensive, as time-consuming, and as litigation. You go to AAA complex litigation rules, you're taking depositions, you're doing all the same stuff. And you've got a decision maker, assuming there's only one, who's charging about $400 an hour, and a clerk, if it's a big enough case, charging about $2,000. Whereas we've got really good judges with clerks, you get in there for $200. So, again, what parties are or aren't doing is hopefully a calculated decision based on the realities of arbitration and the realities of litigation. And if the system is to work and if the arbitration is going to have a proper part in it, the parties have to have the freedom to craft the kind of arbitration that they want.
Again, I hear you. But what I'm struggling with is it just sounds like a fundamental disagreement with Hall. And where's the textual hook within the TAA that would allow a departure from that sort of analysis?
Well, I've answered the question as best I can on that in
and
terms
that would
of textual differences.
171.088, is that the exceed their powers provision?
No, actually, because both the Federal Arbitration Act and the Texas Arbitration Act contemplate limitations on the arbitrator's power. And Hall only decided that you cannot expand judicial review under the Federal Arbitration Act. It did not decide that the parties cannot limit the powers of the arbitrator, which is what happened in this case, which is why we feel that the result we're asking for in this case would be entirely consistent with the Hall opinion, and this court need not necessarily disagree with it.
Do you think that the parties could agree that neither would try to confirm an award that, if it had been the judgment in a case, would not be affirmed on appeal?
I'm sorry, ask the question.
Could the parties agree that neither would try to confirm an award that, had it been a judgment in a case, would not have been affirmed on appeal, thus sort of importing all of the procedural and substantive law safeguards? But instead of the way you've done it here, trying to import some review the way that you've done it, the parties would just agree to limit confirmation that way.
I hadn't thought about it that way. I guess our position is the same thing that the Supreme Court said, which is that you look at the text of the act that you're interpreting, you look at the text of the party's agreement, and you see if the act forbids it or not. There's nothing in either the Federal Arbitration Act or certainly not in the Texas Arbitration Act which says that the parties are forbidden from limiting the powers of the arbitrator. And there are cases out there, not that go to this extent, but there's certainly cases out there where you can limit what kind of evidence the arbitrator hears, you can limit what kind of remedy the arbitrator can render. In fact, that's specifically in the Texas Arbitration Act. And so there's certainly nothing from interpreting the Texas Arbitration Act and interpreting the agreement of the parties in this case that prevents the parties from doing so. And by extension, I think if the language are crafted the way you just suggested, Justice Hecht, I think that would also withstand scrutiny.
It would also what?
Withstand scrutiny. It would also be permissible under the Texas Arbitration Act.
But that would be, as I understood Justice Hecht's question, your modification would be of the court's ability to act. You would, in other words, you would kind of be going against the statute if you precluded confirmation, whereas the statute says it shall confirm if. You know, it's more or less that way. Whereas, as I understand your provision in this case, you're not confronting the statute, but you're just saying that the arbitrators exceeded their powers, which is one of the grounds in which the award could be vacated.
You've helped me understand Justice Hecht's question. But
well, I don't know if I understood.
Actually, let me clarify the question.
I frequently question Justice Hecht, but try to understand his question.
No, I was asking whether the parties could restrict themselves that neither would apply for confirmation unless the award were such that had it been the judgment in the case, it would be affirmed on appeal, and therefore, if somebody did try, moved for confirmation, and you took the position that that wasn't the case, you'd sue them for breach of contract, and then you'd get your review.
All right, I think I understand you better, and I think my answer is the same.
I think it is.
Okay. I'd like to briefly discuss an issue that came up very late in this case, and that is whether we're here under discussing the Texas Arbitration Act or the Federal Arbitration Act. It came up for the first time in this court, and no doubt because while this case was pending on appeal, and to be more specific, after submission, but before the opinion of the Dallas Court of Appeals was reached, the Hall Street opinion came down. It's our position, quite obviously, that it's too late to make an argument that the Federal Arbitration Act applies and preempts. I'm not sure either party's done a really good job of helping the court deal with that distinction. I think we lumped them together. The Federal Arbitration Act does not apply in this case. The reason it doesn't apply at all, much less preempt, is first of all, of course, the defendants are judicially stopped from asserting it now. They didn't just make a legal conclusion to that effect. They specifically represented to the Court of Appeals, the courts below, that the contract that was being arbitrated did not affect commerce, that the transaction did not affect commerce. That's a factual assertion. That's the predicate on which the legal conclusion is reached. And whether a contract affects commerce or not can be a fact-specific inquiry. And so at this late date, to, you know, depriving the trial court and the lower courts of making that determination because of that factual concession ought not allow the respondents to in the Texas Supreme Court, change the law.
Let me just ask you real quick. Have any other states gone your way under their own arbitration statutes? Any of them departed from Hall?
Yes. Both sides, in the form of an exhibit, so I could get it in front of you right now, is just a dead-on-point California Supreme Court case that came out. And I'll discuss it later if I have time. Last night I received a supplemental brief in response from the respondent citing a case law which, according to the email from my office, is distinguishable. But basically, the California Supreme Court case just came square down on every issue. I wish I'd seen it sooner because it would have written my brief for me. And as I understand the respondent's position, there's contrary post-Hall authority following Hall in Georgia and Tennessee. But in that case, those clauses expressly expanded the scope of review instead of what petitioner did in this case, which is deal with the issue of whether or not the arbitrator exceeded his powers. I'll also point out to you that the California Supreme Court case that's before you as Exhibit A is also a case where it dealt with both issues. It both expressly disagreed with Hall and came down on the side of the exceeding powers language. It did both, and it did it under the California Arbitration Act, specifically, as in this case, noting that the person trying to defend the award had always presented it as the California Arbitration Act applying until the Hall Street case came out. And then it did something really fascinating that I didn't think of. It pointed out that it also took the position that when the party elected to come confirm the award in California state courts, it was in effect choosing California law, and federal law did not preempt.
Any further
what's left of my time.
Any further questions? All right, thank you, counsel. Court's ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Ms. Johnson will present argument for the respondent.
Good morning.
Good morning.
As a plaintiff's employment lawyer, I'm learning arbitration as we go, as we can clearly indicate that when we started this case, Ms. Quinn, who's in the court, came to my office 6 years ago, come January. And Ms. Neal, my co-counsel, and I have represented her since that time, and I'm learning as we go. But I'm trying to catch up as fast as I can. And having Mr. Bush clearly articulate to the court where the plaintiff's attorney in the lower brief indicated that the contract was not in commerce presented me with a very interesting issue. If I'm wrong, do I just hide it and move on and just acknowledge it? Or do I just try to grasp all of this law and present the court with what I think the correct position is? And that's what we've done, because frankly, as a lawyer, I can't supplant or surpass the Commerce Clause. I can't do it. And so while I made a stab at it and I was wrong, I've then presented to the court. But let me indicate as well, because I am not conceding that the FAA does not apply here. One has to understand that Mr. Bush and I are plaintiff's lawyers. We've been in the case from the beginning. Mr. Bush came in as appellate law. We're not the arbitral lawyers that we're going to be in the next few years. But let me suggest, how did this case start? Well, we filed a court case petition, straight TCHRA, no other claims. Prior counsel filed a petition moving for mandatory arbitration, citing In re Halliburton. They moved under the FAA. They did not move under the TAA. They did not move under both the FAA and the TAA. They moved under the FAA. And this is in the record, of course, volume one, supported it by the affidavit of the owner, who it clearly indicated commerce facts that the defendant is in the business of retailing new and used shoes, primarily tennis shoes at all, not only in Texas, but to the world. And of course, there was lots of evidence at the trial about Mexican, well, we're taking shoes, Nike shoes down to Mexico, we're getting African contracts. It's clear the Commerce Clause does apply. So I'm not gonna stand and not tell you that I've changed my position because I learned the Commerce Clause applies. Now, the other thing that's interesting though is, unfortunately, I think it's a distinction without a difference. I think it's a tempest in a teapot, because I think this court will only be faced with this issue in the future if solely the Commerce Clause does not apply. And I've done, of course, a lot of reading of this court's cases, the other court's cases, and they all come up under the FAA. Why? Because it's easier. And In re Nexeon is a good example. What happens when you have a balancing of the two? This court's decision in In re Nexeon, basically it started with the defendant trying to move the mandatory arbitration to the TAA. They lost. Why? Because, of course, the plaintiff's attorney, it was a tort case, had not signed off previously, which is a requirement for tort under the TAA, because they opposed arbitration. They weren't going to sign anything. Defendant came back again, this time under the FAA. In other words, like a lot of us, they're changing horses in midstream. This horse was FAA from the beginning, but in Nexeon, they changed horses in midstream and said FAA, and this court said fine. And this court said, really, if you have FAA and TAA, you have to look at a four-point factor, which opposing counsel did indicate in this reply brief. We agreed. Nexeon, I think, squarely controls here. The problem is we disagree with the application in their reply brief, because there's four criteria in Nexeon. And of course, why this case is important, not just for the humble little plaintiff's bar, this case encompasses this, that we're here, could encompass mandatory arbitration for all sorts of industries and all sorts of contract construction, the whole nine yards.
Doesn't seem to me that whether you could appeal, have a broader appeal from an arbitration award, would necessarily favor a plaintiff or a defendant, or work one way in an employment case differently from another case?
I don't know per se. I will say this, I think the whole judicial history of arbitration has been a dramatic 180. In 1967, I think, was the Gardner case, Supreme Court. Absolutely no arbitration that was in a union context. Gilbert came, yes, and so we've been buffeted back and forth. And now the Supreme Court has said, look at it, it's either fish or fowl. If you go to arbitration, this is what you're going to get. You're going to get fast, You're going to get speedy, and you're going to get a very limited review under the statute.
Well, tell
so
me
what, we live with it.
Tell me what they meant, what the Supreme Court meant, when it said the FAA is not the only way into court. For parties wanting review of arbitration awards, they may contemplate enforcement under state statutory or common law, for example, where judicial review or different scope is arguable.
Well, a very careful court left an opening. There's 50 states with 50 state AAs. We have ours. We pointed in the brief, and this is in answer to Justice O'Neill's questions, the striking similarity. I have not researched all 50 states. There's about five or six that fell in, and then there's California. Now, I remember Justice Brister in the, I think it was the Poly America dissent, saying, crazy California. They've always disliked arbitration in California. But I'm a member of the California Bar. I'm not going to go there. But I will say this. The California had a unique history where they had a judicial commission that was, in, I think it was like in 1964, and they went to the legislature after they made recommendations and the legislature adopted them. And so they've had a very strong, differing view on arbitration, which answers, I hope, Justice Heck's question. Whereas the rest of us, we had a legislator legislate for reasons, okay? Most of the cases, most of the courts are going to be on one side, and California is going to be over there. And that's what's turning out. We submitted, and I apologize for the lateness of the day, but I think it's interesting. I don't think it's dispositive. We pointed to the five or six state courts who fell right under Hall. I think we do too, because our statute is so identical. If you have an independent state, such as California, with an independent judicial history that they're trying to reconcile, you're going to fall within that exception, perhaps.
Can you tell me what, when our statute says under 171.088.3a, the arbitrators exceeded their powers, what does that mean? The powers conferred by the arbitration agreement?
I didn't catch the last part of...
When do arbitrators exceed their powers?
Oh.
When they exceed the powers that are conferred in the arbitration agreement?
When they exceed the powers granted by the legislature.
Well, how do we know that? How do we know that that's implied in the statute? It just says exceeded their powers.
I would think that if someone wants to draft more branches on that tree, they'd go back to the legislature. We have a legislative statute that we're seeking to have you enforce, and opposing counsel is adding little Christmas ornaments on the tree.
Yeah, but I mean, let's say that the arbitration agreement says if any dispute arises concerning compensation and only compensation, that will go to arbitration. And let's say that goes to arbitration, the arbitrator not only decides the compensation that you're entitled to, but decides another issue entirely, that decides a tort claim in addition. Do they exceed their powers because they've gone beyond the terms of the agreement?
Well, I think the answer to that could very well be yes, since that is one of the four areas that are consonant in both statutes that exceeded their powers, is something for review. But what's happened is the Fifth Circuit is now moved away from, for example, manifest disregard, where it used to be, if this Justice Heck's thing is, my God, it's a horrible decision. Well, it's manifestly in disregard of the law. Now, the Fifth Circuit is now saying, no, that's not a specific exception. Let me say something that just gets under my skin a little bit as a plaintiff's lawyer. We are not the parties crafting these agreements. So when I hear that the parties have the judicial right to craft these agreements, we are forced participants at the party under In re Halliburton. We don't craft these agreements.
But, But on the other hand, the agreement, an arbitration agreement is an agreement, is it not?
Well, it's like this case, it's in the handbook for an at-will employee, and this court squarely said in Ray Halliburton that the employee by continuing employment abides by that. Yes, sir. But what I'm saying is we're not there at the drafting table saying, you know, let's craft it this way.
But that's a different issue. I mean, there are defenses based on unconscionability, and that's not really before us. We have to presume that it's an arm's-length transaction that was freely bargained.
I don't see it being arm's length. It's not completely before you, but the practicality of the matter is that when we're trying to interpret contract agreements, if one side did not bargain in good faith at arm's length, but had it imposed on them, I don't see how we can just say the parties can agree, the parties can agree.
That is a completely different issue, though. That's not before us. These agreements are imposed upon consumers all the time.
Yes, that's correct. But there seems to be some. I just want to call your attention to the fact that it's not, and I've already made the point, it's not an arm's length thing. But this area is very interesting, and I appreciate the court's interest in it. I will say that Ms. Quinn now has been buffeted for 5 years. We have gone through 4 proceedings. We went to the district court, and then the district court judge changed. The new judge was kind enough to give opposing counsel full briefing, even though the first one had ruled. That was Judge Jordan. And then we went to the Fifth Circuit, full briefing. This is what we call like the full bore appellate briefing. So I have the worst of both worlds. I have not the procedural rights that I would have had in court with a jury and a potential larger jury award, but then I'm faced, if you think this was a good idea, with extensive appellate review and jurisdiction. And I would like to say that this is not an arbitrator who's gone wild. This was voluntarily selected by the parties because Mr. Klautman has 35 years of experience in labor and employment. He was not imposed on the parties. We got together after they filed their FAA petition. We and Ms. Neal says, well, look at your thing.
When you say FAA petition and they moved under the FAA.
Yes, ma'am.
You're only basing that on the fact that they cited Halliburton, right?
No, ma'am. And I'll have to direct your attention to the defendant's verified motion to compel arbitration that moved solely May 31st, 2005, which is in the record and which was cited by the defendant. And it's...
So both sides have switched positions here.
Yes, yes. It's a horse that's crossing the stream. We're all switching.
But now, the Court of Appeals did not make a decision on which statute it was proceeding under because of a concession. So the Court of Appeals did actually not consider the issue because of your position there.
That's correct. It basically went with the Hall argument. I argued in the Court of Appeals.
I mean as to FAA or TAA.
That's
Court
correct.
Of Appeals simply made no decision because you at that point just said the FAA does not apply, so it did not actually pass.
That's
on
correct.
That.
But I did make an argument that we need not reach the Hall decision because there was no substantive errors. And I would like to present to the court this.
You made that argument in the Court of Appeals.
Yes, sir.
Did you make it to the trial court?
This is what I'm getting to. I believe we did. The problem here is that the way their appellate section works, they had no opportunity to say to the, after they got the decision, well, this is wrong. Now, if they'd been smarter, they would have said within 10 days, we can file a reconsideration motion to the arbitrator bringing these arguments. What is, frankly, I find offensive judicially is the fact that, and it's new counsel, it's not anything, you know, personal intent here, but They're making arguments that were never presented to the arbitrator. They're saying state law applies, and it's a horrible mistake that he didn't use state law, when the first counsel only submitted federal law to the arbitrator. And then they're saying it's sex harassment. Well, no one's argued sex harassment. I mean, we've argued the Price Waterhouse type of gender-infused bias is an example of...
But if we thought that a wider review were required by the parties' agreement, where do you think that review has to take place? Here, or in the Court of Appeals, or back in the trial court?
At the first level with the arbitrator by some sort of reconsideration. Bare minimum at the trial court is the second level. But presumption, of course, if you're going to draft a contract that and it's unclear that it's going to be presumed drafted against you. And this is frankly unworkable, because what happens is if you went for this larger review, what you would do is you pull the rug out from the arbitrator. This is their argument, not mine. We don't have to tell your arbitrator all our cases. We're going to give them to the district court, which is what happened here. Federal law to the arbitrator, then we're going to go over to the district court and say that wasn't fair because they didn't cite state law. Well, we didn't. It's fundamentally unfair to the arbitrator, and he has been, I think, unfairly maligned in this case. But I also want to bring back one point on the Nexion case. I think this is a distinction without a difference, because if the court, I surely do not recommend that you allow him to craft stuff onto a statute that the legislator had given its imprimatur to. But assuming that you decided that that was a good idea, and so that you joined California and abandoned the rest of the states that are falling under Hall, I think your Nexion case would preclude enforcement, because you're saying that if the Texas AA, the TAA, is not consonant with the FAA, the FAA will preempt, and that's what Nexion was. Nexion had one extra step, and so you found that was preempted. So if it's consonant, you can go with the TAA, or if there's no commerce whatsoever, it's just a little mom and pop shop.
But didn't Hall expressly say, with the quote that Justice Heck just read, I mean, it kind of said states can interpret their own TAAs. I mean, that Supreme Court seemed itself to say it doesn't preempt.
As careful lawyers, they left the door open for the Californias of the world. I think if you look at your own case law, including the In Re Nexion and D. Wilson, I believe it is, you'll find that you've already said, in the context not of employment but of other arbitrations, that if it's congruent, TAA works. But if it's extra plus or not consonant with the FAA, it's preempted by the FAA. So your prior case law, I think, makes this just a tempest in a teapot. But it's been a pleasure being here to answer your questions.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Briefly, in response on a couple of points, I think I can at least give a clear answer to. The Texas Arbitration Act in section 171.089 specifically says that if an arbitrator's award is vacated, the court may order a rehearing before new arbitrators. Whether that means, you know, whether that may means should or if it just should just go to the district court, that's something I'm not sure has to be decided today, but that's what the TAA says.
Well, your review issues are briefed, But they weren't decided by the Court of Appeals.
That's right.
Were they reviewed by the trial court?
Couldn't get an answer. Specifically asked for findings of fact and conclusions of law, so I could tell. Are you just saying that we can't do this at all, or are you looking at the award and agreeing with it? And
so you presented them to the trial court, but didn't get a ruling, and right. Or you couldn't tell whether you did or not. And is it your understanding of your agreement, of your arbitration agreement, that review would first take place in the trial court if you're correct about the agreement?
I guess I never thought about that. That seems to be the next place to go after arbitration would be the district court.
Well, somebody has to move to confirm the award or
right.
vacate it.
That's right, and that's what happened in this case is that the respondent filed their lawsuit in state court under state law. We moved to compel arbitration in N. Ray Halliburton. And
so then, you would argue under your agreement that the place to argue reversible error would have been the trial court.
I think that has to be it. It raises an interesting question: where are the trial courts almost superfluous if the court were to grant appellate review? Wouldn't it almost make more sense to go straight to an appellate court or something? But then I thought more, well, that's what happens when bankruptcy appeals of non-core proceedings and stuff like that. So I think that's probably the way it ought to go. If that's the way this court chooses to go, I still contend that it's still perfectly appropriate to not actually go the extra step of California and specifically hold directly contrary to the U.S. Supreme Court that you can expand the scope of review, although it does indirectly lead to the same result as the Dallas Court of Appeals pointed out. In this case, we can just hold that the Texas Arbitration Act allows you to limit the powers of the arbitrator. Clearly
counsel,
in this case.
If we go under 171.08.8 3A, saying that we're trying to determine here whether the arbitrator exceeded the powers granted in the agreement. If you read your agreement here, as I understand, the arbitrator does not have authority to render a decision containing a reversible error of state or federal law, among other things. Now, it might be troublesome to some that if that is a standard, the arbitrator may not even be a lawyer. How do we take a non-lawyer and grant that non-lawyer authority bound by reversible error that he or she or the panel may not even have a clue about what we're talking about? And that seems, if we're going to just make it up as far as what their powers are, how does that really help the parties out? It seems like you almost are always asking for one side or the other to get this thing remanded to a new arbitrator if we give them that kind of power.
I can see how in the hypothetical you've presented that would be troublesome, and I can only submit to you in response that the arbitrator's powers does come from the agreement of the parties, from the
right.
contract. And I can only presume that if the parties are going to agree that a non-lawyer be the arbitrator, that it's unlikely they're also going to have the clause in asking for a very legalistic type limitation on that arbitrator's authority.
Well,
they would
that
be contracting.
That clause is in before you select the arbitrator.
True.
And looking at other opposing counsel's side, they've gone through a lot of process here that, it's sometimes people say it's a little overbalanced toward an employer as opposed to an employee or whatever. The employer can be there a long time. The employee has to go to work somewhere else. So it looks as though you might, that might be troublesome in affecting one of these.
Well, if the parties had that clause and still chose to have a non-lawyer arbitrator, I can see how that'd be a problem, but they're still free to make contracts. They're still free to say, we thought about it, and maybe we ought to just have a non-lawyer decide this, and let's not have this limitation on their powers. Let's just let this non-lawyer do whatever, that specialist in that particular construction defect or whatever, do what they want to do.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counselor. That concludes the argument in that case, and the court will take another brief recess.